Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up, it's Flag Day, which has always been special locally, but especially so for the 50th anniversary of Findlay's designation as Flag City, USA. We'll speak with Mayor Christina Mern. Also in our conversation with the mayor, after a delay of more than a decade, the city is ready to address issues with a number of properties that are not in compliance with federal floodplain regulations. Why has it taken so long? New York Times bestselling author Lexi Blake talks about her new romance novel, My Royal Showmance, and the enduring popularity of a genre that makes for the perfect summertime beach read. And we have another collection of delicious, easy-to-make recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Friday, June 14th, 2024. In addition to it being Flag Day today, which obviously is very important in Flag City, USA, Father's Day is this weekend. The origins of Father's Day, this is kind of interesting, the origins of Father's Day, not real well known. This year officially marks the 51st anniversary of the day dedicated to dads. It actually was not until 1972 that Father's Day was recognized as an official day in America, kind of one of those quasi-holidays, not like we get the day off work or anything, but recognized as a day to dedicated to dads on a the proposal was signed off by President Nixon, 1972. So, I mean, President Nixon obviously had his shortcomings, but the Father's Day proclamation, there we go. That's one thing he got right. Sonora Dodd, the daughter of a Civil War veteran, is credited with organizing the first ever Father's Day back in 1910 to honor her father. And because her father's birthday was in June, that's when she wanted that to be. So that's the story. How much of that is accurate, we don't really know. But it is Father's Day this weekend. So if you are celebrating with dad, maybe you're having a cookout or something like that, right? You're going to enjoy the day with dad. Don't get on his case if he's not eating healthy. This I thought was kind of interesting. Study published in the Journal of Retailing looked at how people buy healthy foods and what they buy with their healthy foods. And if you're wondering, well, that doesn't make any sense. Think about this. Have you ever bought fruit or a salad and then rewarded yourself for eating healthy with an extra cookie or something like that, right? We've all done this, right? We've had something healthy and then we reward ourselves with something unhealthy. And hopefully the healthy stuff counteracts the unhealthy stuff. Well, this study suggests that consumers do, in fact, seesaw when they go grocery shopping. We do this not just in restaurants and things like that, but when we go to the grocery store. We alternate between healthy and unhealthy purchases. Dutch scientists conducted two studies analyzing what shoppers scan or add to their cart, and consistently, a healthy choice was followed by an unhealthy choice. So we go to the grocery store and we do a one-for-one in the aisles. Although they do point out that the balancing act seemed to wane the longer the shopping trip went on. So we start off with that and then we just kind of, it doesn't say whether we give up on the healthy stuff or the unhealthy stuff, but I think we all know which one we are more likely to give up on. They call it shopper fatigue. Anyway, some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your TGI Friday morning started. The Ohio House of Representatives has passed a bill known as the Crown Act. It would prohibit public schools from discriminating against a student's hairstyle. HB 178. The Crown Act stands for Creating a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair. The bill would prohibit public schools in Ohio from penalizing students for wearing their hair in natural styles, such as braids, afros, or dreadlocks. I don't know if this has been a big problem in Ohio's public schools to this point? Is this a big urgent thing? I don't know. But then again, I'm not in the ethnic group that would have braids, afros, or dreadlocks. So, who am I to say? This is a national movement. The Crown Act has garnered attention in an effort to address concerns of racial and ethnic discrimination. And now that this bill has passed the House, it will head to the Senate for hearings. So stay tuned. I would update you on that. Also, making statewide news, you remember the story that we had, was it yesterday? We were talking about the camels that got loose at Cedar Point and were wandering around the Frontier Trail. The camels got loose from the petting zoo. Well, now PETA has gotten involved. No big shock here. The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has requested that the U.S. Department of Agriculture investigate Honey Hill Farm, which is a Kentucky-based mobile petting zoo that supplies the camels and the other animals for the petting zoo at Cedar Point. They don't actually own the camels, Cedar Point. They subcontract this sort of thing out. And so with PETA's formal complaint being filed, it is expected that the Ag Department will visit Cedar Point to ensure that the animals are safe and in good health. So you knew that PETA was going to get involved. You knew that PETA was going to get involved. The Pope is making headlines today. Did you hear about this? He's going to be at the G7 summit, the first pontiff to attend a G7 summit. Statement from the Vatican says the 87-year-old pontiff will hold bilateral meetings with world leaders and will discuss the ethical implications of artificial intelligence. So is it really going to be the Pope, or is it just going to be an AI representation of the Pope? I don't know. Anyway, the attendance of Pope Francis is a break with the Roman Catholic tradition of refusing invitations to world summits. And that's not all that the Pope is going to be doing today. Also, he's going to be meeting with a host of comedians from around the globe. The Pope and a bunch of comedians are going to get together to celebrate the beauty of human diversity. Those who are invited to attend include Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Fallon, Chris Rock, Whoopi Goldberg, and Conan O'Brien. So that should be, I would love to be a fly on the wall for that meeting. I mean, all of those comedians and the Pope, that will be fun. That will be fun. So big news in the world of college sports. Reports surfaced yesterday that the Big 12 is exploring a naming rights deal for the conference itself. For the conference. The idea, apparently floated by Commissioner Brett Yormark, would potentially be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Reportedly, the title sponsor, which is rumored to possibly be Allstate Insurance, would replace the word big in the conference title, as in the Allstate 12. Ross Dellinger, writing for Yahoo Sports, says a final determination has not been made, and any agreement must gain the necessary support from the Big 12 presidents and chancellors. A conference spokesperson declined to comment when reached on Thursday, the report says. So he declined to comment. But I would imagine if he had commented, the comment would be something like, I don't know what the hell they're thinking. I mean, I guess I can see. I mean, maybe it's surprising that it's taken this long. I mean, we've had the Capital One Orange Bowl and the Pop-Tart Bowl and the Cheez-It Bowl and the Duke's Mayonnaise Bowl. We've had those forever. We've had naming rights for stadiums forever. So I guess this is the next logical extension of that. The concept is a months-long endeavor spearheaded by Commissioner Yormark, who, by the way, is a former New York entertainment and talent executive. He's not a sports guy who's the commissioner of the sports conference. He is a former New York entertainment and talent executive. That pretty much removes any pretense that that college sports is about the sports, doesn't it? The fact that the conference commissioner is an entertainment and talent executive, former entertainment and talent executive. So, I mean, it's all about the entertainment value, the bottom line, all of that. So not a big surprise in the Allstate 12. I don't know. Make of that what you will. And lastly, here among the first things you need to know, most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your day started. Circle back to Father's Day here for this item. Think about this. The latest ranking of the best and worst states for working dads. Wallet Hub is out with their list. The top five best places for working dads, according to Wallet Hub. And by the way, they compared 21 key indicators, ranking everything from the average length of the workday to childcare costs to the overall health of men. Massachusetts was number one. Number one state for working dads in 2024. Washington, D.C., which for the purposes of the study, they consider the 51st state, that landed at number two. Connecticut, New Jersey, and Minnesota, the rest of the top five. Massachusetts, number one because of its great economic conditions for dads. It also has the best parental leave policy of any state and the best school systems in the country, according to their ranking. The worst states for working dads: Louisiana, Alabama, Arkansas, Arizona, and South Carolina. So make of that what you will. I have no idea where Ohio ranked, but we're not in the top. We're not in the bottom. So there you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Friday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather becoming mostly sunny today with the high in the low 80s. Mostly clear tonight, low around 60. Meteorologists are warning that the Buckeye State will experience dangerously hot conditions next week.
A dangerous heat wave is headed to the state of Ohio with temperatures in the upper 90s to near 100 early next week. Heat indices will be close to 105. Air quality may also be poor at times, and people with breathing issues should limit their time outdoors and take extra precautions.
ONN meteorologist Dylan Robichaud reporting. Remember, you can always get the latest forecast and weather alerts on our website. For professionals serving youth in Hancock County, the Family Resource Center has a comprehensive training session on the Youth Thrive Framework coming up. Ashley Cheney is Youth Engagement Lead at the Family Resource Center.
During this event, you will learn about the five protective and promotive factors that pave the way to youth well-being, as well as gain valuable insight and tools to support youth in our community.
Ashley says the training is ideal for educators, social workers, policymakers, law enforcement personnel, and other direct service workers, and it aims to equip participants with the knowledge needed to understand younger people better and promote their long-term well-being. Get details about registering for the training in the story on our website. Ohio U.S. Senator J.D. Vance has introduced legislation that would ban federal government-funded diversity programs.
The dismantled DEI Act would forbid government contractors from using federal money to fund DEI programs, but it would also bring all current DEI initiatives to a close. DEI programs were established to promote fair treatment and inclusion for underrepresented minorities. This includes race, gender, and sexual orientation.
ONN's Clay Gordon reporting. The Tiffin Police Department is reminding people to always lock their vehicles. The department says over the past month and a half, they've had three vehicles stolen in the community, with two of the thefts occurring in just the past 2 weeks. All three vehicles were unlocked with the keys located in the vehicle. The police department is asking people to follow some essential safety tips, and you can get those in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online at WFIN.com.
So now our cover story this morning on this Flag Day. We are joined by Findlay Mayor Christina Mern. And as we were mentioning earlier, you know, Flag Day obviously has always been a very special day locally, but especially so for the 50th anniversary of Findlay's designation of Flag City USA.
Yeah, definitely. It's always a fun celebration, but 50 years of having this congressional designation is just something fun to celebrate.
And, you know, we were talking with Sarah Foltz of the Historical Museum, earlier this month ahead of their big celebration of the 50th anniversary. And one of the things we were talking about, get your thoughts on this, it is the way the community really embraces that designation.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really a part of our community identity and something to just that's unique about us. But I think that just really represents two main characteristics: that we're proud of our community and country, and two, that we come together with things that we believe in, right? So 50 years ago, a resident, John B. Cook, had a vision, and different community organizations came together and had this flag display across our community. And I think it's, you know, a small symbol, but it's just something that shows when that our community is a community that works together to have a vision come to life.
Yeah. So obviously very important for folks to fly their flags proudly today of all days. So we'll put that out there.
Yeah.
I did want to ask you about a couple of business items that I've been in the headlines. The city is looking to secure grant funding for updates to the Blanchard Street Bridge. That is the one by the water treatment plant in Centennial Park, correct?
Correct.
So what kinds of updates are we talking about? Are we talking about completely replacing that bridge, or what's going to be happening, or what's the plan there?
Yeah, so the specifics are not yet known because we need to check. Obviously, as when we start moving forward with a project, we'll go through a full assessment and determine the extent. Overall, the bridge structurally, my understanding, is in good condition, but it will need to be redecked. So that means that a large portion of it is going to be removed either by milling or demolished. And then we're going to go down to more of the beam structure to put in a new deck on it. So it's not just a simple kind of mill a portion down and re-asphalt it or you know, put more concrete kind of mm-hmm. as a minimal layer. But my understanding is that it will be a more substantial redecking of the bridge. And this is not unusual. We, for, you know, years have worked with ODOT and, you know, state organizations to secure funding specifically for bridges.
Right.
That's a program that we've participated in for years and then are working with them to hopefully help cover that cost.
So does this represent the bridge that is the highest priority in the city, or is it a matter of this one being able to qualify for the grant money that you are seeking?
This one is our highest priority. Okay. Over the next probably 10 years, we will be working on some other bridges. I know and some of them are county managed, some of them are city managed, but we work with the county on getting those projects as well. But, you know, Bright Road, that bridge, we're starting to see wear and tear. So we definitely will have a program to kind of get all of those updated. But right now, the Blanchard Street Bridge is one of our primary focus areas.
And as we were mentioning, you are seeking a grant to help defray the cost, assuming that that grant is approved. It doesn't sound like this is work that would be done this year, though.
No, most likely 2026 would be okay. The earliest that this project would occur.
Okay, so this is a ways out yet. One other item that I know will be on the agenda for next week's city council meeting. After a lengthy delay, the city is finally looking to address issues with a number of properties that are not in compliance with federal floodplain regulations. What types of issues are we talking about, and what needs to be done?
Yeah, so this is, as many federal programs are, has been really kind of convoluted, and our FEMA representative has been great to work with, but it's been definitely a lengthy process. And some of the reasons that it was delayed was because we've been kind of going back and forth with FEMA to try to resolve as many of the questions, comments, concerns that they brought up before we really had to do any remediation work. And so the properties that now have been identified as needing kind of remediation, different vents put into crawl spaces to help with air circulation and, you know, being able to dry areas out that may historically have higher levels of moisture.
Mm-hmm.
Could be things, there could be crawl spaces that maybe need filled in. So they're all relatively minor issues that we think are going to have to be addressed. A primary one is certificates of surveying showing the, you know, where the base flood is compared to the foundation. And so now we've identified these are things that are required for the city to work on fixing to be in compliance with the Federal Emergency Management Agency floodplain regulations and our community rating. And so when we've talked about community rating in the past, this is how we are determined, kind of the risk and properties are assessed for their flood insurance. Mm-hmm. And so things, the better the city does with managing that, whether it's the processes, the floodplain management, helps our score improve and then trickles down to benefiting the residents because they are able to get better rates on their insurance because when we have a better rate, because it's just like our fire response rating. When we have an improved rating, it benefits the residents. And these are properties that, you know, whether the city didn't have appropriate compliance when we worked with the property in the past, or we just don't have documentation on record, that's what we now need to work through. And the city, I have, you know, said, let's just move forward with the city taking on getting these done, so that we have it taken care of and can move on and be in a good light with FEMA.
As you were mentioning, there's been a lot of dialogue going on back and forth. These are issues that were actually identified more than a decade ago. So this has taken a long time. You mentioned the dialogue back and forth. I know the pandemic kind of slowed things down with respect to that as well. But might that delay actually turn out to be something of a blessing in disguise? Because obviously we've done a lot of flood mitigation work over the course of the past decade, which would theoretically change some of those equations if the certification had been done before, those numbers would change.
I would love to say yes, but not really. It really is okay. Something that should have just been taken care of. It's not something that we can wait, you know, a couple more years until all the flood projects are done to be able to just say, oh, well, you know, this isn't a problem anymore. These are documents and remedies that are going to have to be addressed regardless of any of the improvements made for flood, for our flood mitigation effort. And so, you know, it helps because maybe we better understand the process, but I would say overall, this is something that we're not really seeing a benefit because of all the efforts that we've put into flood mitigation quite yet.
Now, one point to clarify on this, my understanding is that none of the properties in question are city owned, and yet the city is responsible for the expense of bringing them into compliance with the appropriate standards. Why?
Yeah, so I want to I appreciate you clarifying so I can further clarify as well, is the city is taking on the responsibility of doing the initial surveying and assessment of the properties. And most likely we will also then just pay to get the issues remedied. And there's a couple reasons why. And I say most likely because if there is a significant issue identified, I'm not expecting the city to pay for that. We will have to evaluate it. But right now, based off of the information that we have, the majority of the issues are going to be very low cost. And I didn't think it was right when really the only reason we're having to take these actions now is because and do these remedies is because the city didn't have people do them previously. And it could be somebody completely new that didn't own the property that doesn't even realize that they should have done this.
Mm-hmm.
And so for $15,000, probably less than that, that's what we've set aside. That's what we're asking for council to appropriate for us to be able to do this. That would get property surveyed, the proper paperwork complete, as well as potentially put in venting or help, you know, put in gravel into a crawl space, do those different things. But as we work through this process, if there's a problem identified that's more significant, that is something that isn't necessarily one of these minor things that was the initial cause for us contacting them, mm-hmm. I'm not expecting the city of Findlay to cover that cost. I'm hoping we don't run into any of those issues, but if we do, that's not an automatic, hey, the city is responsible for this. It will be a conversation with the property owner to determine the appropriate course of action.
And just to underscore what you were saying a little bit earlier, if these issues are not corrected, if these properties are not brought into compliance, the city actually would potentially risk its participation in the National Flood Insurance Program?
Correct. Non-compliance with FEMA's regulations, which currently is kind of how we are labeled could pose issues with our overall community rating and put us in a state of noncompliance.
So obviously that would have an impact on all the property owners within the city of Findlay, not just those who are impacted directly by these issues.
Correct.
Certainly something to keep in mind with respect to that. Again, Findlay Mayor Christina Murn with us this morning on this Flag Day. Again, a quick reminder, make sure that everybody gets their flags out and fly them proudly today.
Thanks, Chris. Great to hear from you.
Well, it is definitely the time of year to lose yourself in a good beach read, and we have one title that you want to pick up if you're in the mood for a hot summertime romance. New York Times bestselling author Lexi Blake is with us this morning to talk about her latest book, My Royal Showmance. And Lexi, the romance genre has been very good to you. You've written literally 100 titles, nearly a dozen series. What got you started in writing these stories?
Well, I think I started the way most writers start, by reading. I read a lot. I was pretty much a voracious reader as a child.
Yeah.
My mother was very into romance novels. So at a pretty early age, I started picking up the books that she had lying around the house, and I was just kind of hooked from there.
So you kind of naturally gravitated to this. And I know people sometimes dismiss this genre. I mean, we used to call them dime store paperbacks. I don't know if anyone really uses that term anymore, but this is a billion-dollar industry with more than 70 million readers. What is the sustaining power? I mean, what's the draw? What's the attraction? What brings so many people into this genre?
I think the real draw at the heart of all of it is that it's a very hopeful genre. And it's also, it's very much comfort food. These are things you can sit down and read, and you know you're going to go through a lot. The characters tend to go through a lot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of angst. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of twists and turns. There's a lot of heartbreak. But you know, after all of that, you're going to get a happily ever after. I think the real sustaining power of romance is its message that we're going to be okay.
I wonder, as a writer, as you're crafting these stories, is that part of the fun in crafting, is all of that angst that you talk about that they go through in order to get to that happily ever after? I mean, is that sort of a devilish pleasure?
Absolutely. I've had readers send me these little candles that say, you know, this is powered by the tears of my reader. Of course, it's the best part. And any author who tells you that they don't love putting their characters through the ringer, they're lying.
Now, that's kind of what I suspected. In the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that romance is not necessarily my cup of tea, but my wife finished this latest book, My Royal Showmance, in like 2 days. So tell us what
is awesome.
Tell us what is going on in this book.
So kind of the premise is my heroine, Annika, she is a production assistant. Her boss asked her to kind of go undercover on a show she wouldn't normally be working on. This is a reality dating show, because the director of the show, there have been some rumors about him. So she wants Annika to go in and kind of investigate these rumors.
Okay.
Well, the first day she shows up, one of the contestants drops out. She kind of fits the dress she was going to wear. So they shove her in the dress, put her in a carriage to go meet this king, who is supposed to cut her at the first ceremony so she can go back to work. He takes one look at her and is like, nah, I'm going to keep her around.
And
so that's kind of where we start from.
And we're off. Now, I mentioned my wife loved the book, and she did not realize until she was done reading it that this is actually the second in your latest series, with the third coming, what, next year? Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, the third one will be out next May. But that means that I did a good job. it can be read as a standalone. You don't need to know what happened in the first book. Hopefully, though, if you're interested, you can go back and read the first book.
So this is really a hectic pace that you keep, as many romance writers do. how do you do it? I mean, you being able to write so many stories at this kind of a clip and still manage to maintain the connection that you seem to have with both the characters you are writing about and the readers that you are writing for.
You know, it comes down to just figuring out how to work, how you work best. For me, I struggled for a lot of years, basically working all day, 7 days a week, trying to get all of this done. Mm-hmm. And then I found out the magic of, weirdly enough, this is one of the blessings from 2020, Zoom became a thing. I found out I work best when I have coworkers. So now, instead of being alone, I always thought I was the ultra introvert. Instead of being alone, I get on Zoom about 4 hours a day and write with friends of mine. And I'm much more productive in those 4 hours than I ever was in the 8 to 10 I was working.
Interesting.
So I think it's about figuring out how you work best.
Yeah. And we mentioned it's not just the connection with the characters that you're writing about and crafting these stories in kind of a breakneck pace, but also connecting with the readers, because I know that's another part of what makes romance such a popular genre.
I think the way that we write and the way that we connect with readers, it makes them kind of part of our world and we welcome them into it. So there really is that personal connection to the reader, and social media helps us really do that.
Sure.
We get to basically go on and, you know, show them parts of our world, show them what we're working on, really listen to them when they tell us things like, I connected to this character. And those are some of the really great things about social media.
I'm wondering about that too, because you can make that connection. I mean, through the magic of social media and the way that you can interact with readers, how much of that feedback actually becomes part of the story, makes it into, in some way, shape, or form, into the stories or into the characters' narratives?
You know, I think that you want to listen to your readers when they tell you, we love this character, we really want to see him, you know, we really think that he should have a story. I don't know how much an author, like, I have had readers suggest, I would really like to see this.
Yeah.
Well, I know why it's not going to work in the pacing of a story.
Yeah.
But I will listen all day long to, we love this character, we really want to see this. Or, you know, I think that we definitely listen to them about some of the things they want, maybe not about the mechanics of writing.
Yeah. So as we mentioned, the new title, My Royal Showmance, actually will be out next month. But if you can't wait to, you know, for that, you can get
it
your...
It came out on Tuesday.
Oh, it did come out on Tuesday. I'm sorry. I was thinking next month. I knew that my wife got the advanced copy, but she immediately went back and got the first book in the series to catch up.
Awesome.
So again, speaks volumes about the story itself. Lexi Blake with us this morning. Do you have a website where folks can learn more about this book and this series?
I do. It's www.lexiblake.net, and all of my books, you can read the first chapter for free and see if you like it.
All right, Lexi Blake, thanks very much for taking the time. Certainly best of luck for continued success with the book.
Thank you so much, Chris.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Here's another story of a spill on a highway. You remember earlier this week we had the story about the watermelons that were spilled on, what was it, in Iowa or something, in Interstate 80. They had a tough time cleaning it up because the local wildlife came and helped themselves to a snack. Well, here is another spill on a highway. A truck carrying liquid chocolate crashed in Pennsylvania. The tanker transporting the sweet goods rolled over near an off-ramp on Interstate 81 in Hazle Township, H-A-Z-L-E Township. The leak was addressed by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, the Department of Transportation, and state police. Can you imagine having to clean up all of that liquid chocolate from the highway? What a mess that must have been. Here's the ironic part. You know where the truck was heading? Hershey, Pennsylvania, of course. Hershey, Pennsylvania. Yeah. So that was kind of an accident you could see coming. You know, you should have. You know that's going to happen. Elsewhere in the broken news, the odd and unusual side of the headlines, a man released from San Quentin State Prison in California turned around and robbed a bank in Anaheim the very next day. So he was not rehabilitated. Federal prosecutors have filed charges against Eric Gray, who they say robbed a bank on May 8th, taking three employees hostage while claiming to have a gun. Whether he actually was in possession of a firearm is not clear. At his arrest, police found he had cash and drugs. He is also accused of trying to escape after being taken to a hospital and fighting officers, leaving several of them injured. So he is now facing up to 20 more years in federal prison if convicted. The day after he was released from prison. The day you couldn't wait 48 hours. You couldn't wait a week. You had to do that the next day. Wow. not rehabilitated. Wells Fargo, the bank. Wells Fargo has fired over a dozen employees for allegedly faking work. More specifically, the employees were suspected of simulating keyboard activity to make it seem like they were being more productive than they actually were. So the boss would walk by the cubicle and they'd start typing on their keyboard to make it look like they were actually doing something. In early 2022, Wells Fargo asked most employees to come back to the office. And apparently some employees were not happy about that, so they started faking work. Wells Fargo representative for the bank said, Wells Fargo holds employees to the highest standards and does not tolerate unethical behavior. So, you know, there's a line from the film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid where I think it's Butch says, you know, if he would take the money that he was paying these guys to chase me down and keep me from robbing his trains, if he'd pay me the money that he was paying them to keep me from robbing his trains, I wouldn't rob his trains. This is the kind of thing. Dude, if they would have spent the money on the employees that it took to investigate the fact that they were faking work, they'd give that to the employees. Maybe the employees wouldn't fake work. I'm just saying. The annual Italian Market Festival in Philadelphia. They've got a problem in Philly. The Italian Market Festival ended a month ago, but some meats and cheeses from this year's event are still dangling from a pole. I don't know why. Did they hang these things on a pole in the Italian Market Festival? Apparently so. Organizers say they are working to remove the unclaimed food. It's been there for a month. They are working to remove the unclaimed food, which was left there on the last day of the festival because weather conditions made it impossible to take down the pole. It was stormy weather. But nobody came back for the stuff. A crane, apparently it's a very tall pole, because a crane will be needed to remove the bounty, but the process will be difficult as it is in an often crowded area. So it would be difficult to use people all around and commuting to work and so on and so forth. So there's a very busy spot of town, which makes it more complicated to get the job done. Fortunately, visitors say that they have yet to notice any foul odors. So, let's see. A couple of other items here in the broken news, the odd and unusual side of the headlines from the international file this morning. The former mayor of Rio de Janeiro, Cesar Maia, was caught during a video call sitting on the toilet. Apparently, he had joined in a virtual city council meeting discussing that was called a virtual city council meeting called to discuss designation of a cultural heritage site when he appears to be sitting on the throne, as it were. Moments into the call, the president of council asks the ex-mayor to turn his camera off. Can you just turn that off? So we don't need to see that. the mayor can be seen moving. The president of the council can be seen moving the microphone away as he holds back laughter. The former mayor said he was feeling unwell, which is more information than we wanted to know as to why he was sitting on the toilet. He said the whole incident has damaged his perception of virtual meetings. Yeah, I would think that would do it. I wouldn't be too thrilled with the idea of virtual meetings after that either. and he'll never be able to live this down. And finally, in the broken news, we just got past graduation season, right? Kids, high school, college, kindergarten graduations, and all of that. It's graduation season, really special time in the lives of kids and their parents. And attendees of a Massachusetts middle school graduation probably thought they were seeing double many times over. According to a report in the Associated Press, the eighth grade class of Pollard Middle School in Needham, Massachusetts, includes a total of 23 sets of twins. 23 sets of twins. Now, this is in a class of approximately 450 to 500 children. This is a school that has about 450 to 500 kids in each grade. So to have 23 sets of twins is quite the anomaly. The principal, Tamatha Bibbo, says we typically have anywhere from 5 to 10 sets at most. 23 sets of twins. She said the principal said that she congratulates all of the siblings on their accomplishments, and she looks forward to their accomplishments in the future in high school. And I'm sure she also issued an apology to the high school for and all of their future teachers for what's to come. You know what I mean? This is what we're unleashing on you. 23 sets of twins in the class. That's amazing. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
How to stay safe when a tornado threatens. The best thing to do is make sure you're prepared. Know your area's tornado risk. The Midwest has a greater risk for tornadoes. Know the signs of a tornado and sign up for your community's warning system. Pay attention to weather reports and identify and practice going to a safe shelter. Take an active role in your safety. Go to ready.gov and search tornado for more information. This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. And this is why it's important to spend time with your dad this Father's Day. In a new survey of 2,000 adults age 40 and over, 88%, an overwhelming 88% say doing activities with their parents has had a positive impact on their relationship. In fact, 58% say they feel closer to their parents now than they ever have at the age of 40 or above. 58% feel closer to their parents now than ever before. And it doesn't have to be anything, you know, wildly involved. It can be just simple things. 33%, when asked about the shared experiences that they most enjoy between adults and their parents, 33% just go shopping together. One in three would just go shopping together. 26% enjoy dining out, going, trying new restaurants. 16% will travel with their parents and discover new places. And 6% of those in the survey say they go to concerts together, which is kind of interesting. All kinds of concerts, types of concerts you can go to, but going to concerts together. Just some of the things that people are doing with their parents. And it's kind of interesting, all of this quality time sometimes results in some surprising discoveries. One respondent in the survey said that they learned that their parent was once friends with Elvis Presley, something they never knew before. So you never know what you might find out. And to drive the point home, in the survey, 64% of respondents say that their parents keep a positive attitude about aging when they spend time with their adult children. So, again, it's why it's important to spend time with your dad this Father's Day. And now, once again, as is traditional, the final segment on the final day of the week, my wife Kyra has joined us in the studio with another collection of delicious and easy to make recipes from Kyra's Kitchen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, bright eyed and bushy tailed here this morning.
I already took a shower today.
Which, by the way, is not always the case.
Nope.
When we are doing the program from the home studio.
Nope.
Because,
usually it's pajamas.
Because it's radio, and yeah. Who cares?
Yeah.
It's one of the people sometimes ask me, have you ever wanted to get into television? You do it. I said, no, I'm fine with radio. Yep. I can just roll out of bed and into the studio, and nobody cares what I look like.
Yep.
So,
nope.
Yeah, there are some perks to you not being able to see us. Anyway, this is just a random collection. It's not like it's necessarily a special Father's Day or any particular theme.
Although these would be good for
Father's Day. Yeah. Sure, absolutely. Yes, we have, first of all, a very easy and really tasty, a recipe for a sausage tortellini skillet.
Yes, so this is 12 ounces of smoked skinless sausage sliced, a half a cup of onion diced, 1 tablespoon of garlic minced, 1 cup of bell peppers. I used both green and red, chopped. And then 8 ounce thing of tortellini. I actually put more in. I probably had like about 12 ounces of tortellini in there.
Okay.
But I like pasta. So if you love pasta.
You're a pasta fan.
Yes, add some more. It's okay.
Okay.
1 teaspoon of Italian seasoning, 24 ounce of pasta sauce. I use my marinara that I like. And 2 cups of shredded mozzarella cheese. So preheat your oven to 350 degrees in a large skillet. Add the sausage, onion, and garlic, and saute that all together. Heat on medium-high until onions are translucent and sausage begins to brown about 5 minutes. Then stir in your peppers and heat for an additional 3 to 5 minutes. Add your pasta sauce, your Italian seasoning, your cheese. Stir all that well. Top with the remaining cheese and place in the preheated oven. Bake for about 10 minutes until cheese is melted and serve immediately.
There you go. The sausage tortellini skillet is really easy and really yummy. To go along with that, we have a recipe for Italian bruschetta.
Yes. So this is 5 Roma tomatoes diced. 2 tablespoons of basil chopped, 4 tablespoons of minced garlic, 1 tablespoon of white wine vinegar, 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 1 tablespoon of sugar, 1/2 teaspoon of sea salt, 1/4 teaspoon of black pepper, some balsamic glaze, that's optional. Then your ingredients for your toast is 1 baguette of Italian bread, thinly sliced, 3 tablespoons of virgin olive oil, and some kosher salt. So core and dice your tomatoes, drain any excess juice, and transfer your tomatoes to a medium bowl. Add in the basil, the garlic, the vinegar, the olive oil, the sugar, salt, and pepper. Stir all that gently to combine and set it aside to marinate for 15 to 30 minutes. Then you can serve it with your bruschetta toast and drizzled with the balsamic vinegar. So to make your bruschetta toast, preheat your oven to 400 degrees with your rack in the center of the oven. Place sliced bread on parchment-lined baking sheet. Brush the bread with olive oil and kind of, I try and get both sides.
Yeah,
and
you're going to want to do both sides.
Yeah, and I just use the extra olive oil that's on the bottom that always drips, and I just kind of
Okay.
Move my bread around and then sprinkle the top with your sea salt and bake for at 400 degrees for 7 to 8 minutes or until your edges are golden brown. Mm-hmm. And you don't want the whole thing to be golden brown because in the middle, it's going to be nice and chewy. It's really good.
And you don't have to have a whole lot of sea salt on it.
Nope.
I mean, a little goes a long way with the sea salt. Yep. So there's something there that I noticed when you made this the other day.
Yes.
So, and then for dessert, we have a recipe for two ingredient lemon bars. You've got lemon, you've got bars. There's your two.
No.
two ingredient lemon bars. So this should be fairly easy.
Yes. So this is a 1 16 ounce angel food cake mix, 1 21 ounce lemon pie filling. Preheat your oven to 350 degrees. In a large bowl, mix together the lemon pie filling and your angel food cake. Use a spoon or spatula to mix everything all together. Don't over mix or whip. So you're better off just using your... My thing's coming off.
Your her headphones
my
are coming
headphones
off. Did you
coming
say
off.
Your thing is coming off?
That doesn't That's, sound very
no,
good.
No, that
does
doesn't sound good. Her headphones are sliding off her
my
head.
My headphones. I'm like disconfigurated today. My hair is going to look awful now. I'm going to have to go do my hair over.
First world problems.
So spray.
Anyway,
okay,
where were
back
we?
To. So then spray a 9x13 inch pan with your non-stick cooking spray, or grease it with some shortening. Just lightly grease. Add the batter to the pan. Spread evenly. Bake in the oven on your center rack for about 25 minutes or until the top starts to brown. Place on a cooling rack and cool for 1 to 2 hours before cutting into squares.
Okay.
And my suggestion when cutting them, especially with this being angel food cake, if you have a plastic serrated knife, that is best.
Okay.
To
Definitely a serrated knife.
Yes. Yes. But plastic, is because they're nice and gooey on top. They're almost, they're still like a lemon bar. They're really good. I love them.
All right.
One of my favorites.
So there you go. And the best part is, again, it's two ingredients. You've got the angel food cake mix and the lemon pie filling, and that's it. That's all you need.
Yep.
So we've got the recipes for the sausage tortellini skillet, the Italian bruschetta, and the two ingredient lemon bars on the Kyra's Kitchen Facebook page at Kyra's Kitchen WFIN on Facebook. If you want to grab those recipes, we also have them linked up at goodmornings.net. And of course, if you don't already follow the Kyra's Kitchen Facebook page, why not? You got to follow her page and get all of the latest recipes and other goodies that we share on social media. And if there's something that you are looking for, if there's a recipe you want to share or one that you're looking for, reach out and let us know. You can message us through Facebook or email us at goodmornings@wfin.com.
Yep.
You okay with your headphones here? You know how these things work. How long have we been doing this? You know how headphones work?
You know, I think...
Don't be blaming it on the cord.
No, it's all your fault. You want to just twist it.
Of course,
it
it's all my fault.
It is.
It's Father's Day. It's
still
always
your fault.
Father's Day weekend is still my fault.
Yep.
Anyway, there you go.
That's why I married you, so
more
I can blame
recipes
you on
from Kyra's Kitchen. My wife, Kyra, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage and that, of course, goodmornings.net. Coming up Monday on the program, election security has been one of the most buzzed about discussions after 2020. Republicans talk about protecting the integrity of the vote. Democrats talk about protecting poll workers from threats of violence. So if everyone agrees it's an important issue, why is funding for election security drying up? So until Monday morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day, a great weekend. We'll catch you back here next week.